I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Gas prices have reached $4 a gallon across the country. Home prices have plummeted. What does one have to do with the other? Our guest, Joe Courtwright, is an economist for Impresa Consulting in Portland, Oregon. His new report, Driven to the Brink, shows how high gas prices are devaluing homes that are farther away from amenity-rich city centers. But what can you do about high gas prices if you can't move away from them? Smart City producer Scotty Iseri brings us a special report about some of the best ways to get around the city that help alleviate the gas crunch. All this plus Planetizen's Nate Berg and City View's commentator Walker Smith on today's special edition of Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Housing values are falling fastest in distant suburban and ex-urban neighborhoods where affordability depended directly on cheap gas. But how did the spike in gas prices burst the housing bubble? That's what our guest Joe Courtwright explores in his latest study, Driven to the Brink. In it, he describes how gas prices, which have doubled in the last few years, have reshaped the landscape of real estate between cities and suburbs. Joe, we've heard all the explanations for the declines in housing prices, exotic lending practices, a wave of foreclosures, but you believe something else is going on.
Well, I think the housing bubble that we experienced over the last few years was bound to burst sooner or later, but it looks like the triggering event for the bubble popping has a lot to do with the big run-up in gas prices we've seen in the last few years.
Why do you say that?
Well, if you look back at the trajectory of housing markets and the change in gas prices, the first thing you notice is that the peaking of the housing market coincided almost exactly with the big run-up in gas prices we saw starting in about 2004. And as gas prices have continued to accelerate, the housing market, which was experiencing this big bubble, has actually gone into very sharp decline. And in the last year, housing prices in the country are down by more than 10%.
Now, have those declines occurred everywhere? Does the same pattern exist all over the U.S.?
No, there's substantial regional variations. We know places like California and Florida that had a bigger bubble went down more in the last year than other places. But one of the things we've noticed is that there's a very distinct pattern within metropolitan areas, that the biggest declines in most metropolitan areas where there's a relationship is in those areas furthest from the urban core.
I mean, what happened? Did everyone wake up one day and realize, gosh, gas prices are going up, and so I'm not going to buy that house for the price they're asking in the suburbs? I mean, how does this happen? And how does it happen so suddenly?
Well, I think one of the things that we know about housing markets, especially over the last few years, is that people have been doing what realtors call drive to qualify. That is, if you drive a little bit further out, if you get a longer commute, you can usually find cheaper housing at the edge of a metropolitan area. And both consumers and developers knew that. And when gasoline was cheap, that was a way essentially to lower the price of housing. But those households are ones that ended up spending a much bigger fraction of their income on gasoline. And so when gas prices went up, although that affected everybody, it affected those suburban households a lot more. They've been harder hit, and it's made their housing much less attractive than everybody else's.
Is this true in all U.S. metro areas?
When we look at the data on the changes in house prices by zip code for different metropolitan areas, we find that there's a statistically significant negative relationship. That is, the further out you go, the more prices decline in every metropolitan area for which there is any relationship between geography and price changes. The only exception really is Las Vegas.
And how do you explain that?
Well, the data that we have is just not terribly precise, and that there are a lot of factors that influence house prices. And we looked at the period of the last 12 months. So it's not possible to control for all the different sources of variation. So there's a lot of noise in that data. And the interesting thing is, again, for every market for which there is a statistical relationship, except one, Las Vegas, the relationship is negative, which is a pretty striking finding.
Is that why you're sure you're right?
Well, I mean, the data decidedly conform to the experiences that we hear from people in these communities, from the observations of folks in the real estate community. And it also really accords with our theory of how cities grow. And we know that the United States has a much more decentralized pattern of urban development than other industrialized countries. We know that there's been a lot of suburban development over the last 50 years. And we know theoretically that the reason for that has a lot to do with inexpensive gasoline, much less expensive in the United States than in the rest of the developed world. And the availability of cheap gasoline has made suburban low-density development economically feasible and economically attractive. So it's not particularly surprising that when gas prices actually more than double in just the last few years, that should have an impact on the attractiveness of suburban living.
Did you figure the effect, Joe, of transit on housing prices in the work you did?
No, we didn't look directly at transit. We know that generally transit is better in the middle of metropolitan areas, in those close-in neighborhoods, and is not so good in the suburbs. But even in some suburbs, there will be better transit than other suburbs, and we really didn't look at that factor separately.
Do you think it might? I mean, what's your guess, or can you make a guess?
Well, from what we hear from folks in the real estate community is buyers are putting a pretty strong premium on places that have good access to transit or that are bikeable and walkable and dense, because what that means is they won't be quite so dependent on automobile travel for all the basic necessities of life, and they'll have more choices about how to get to different places.
As someone who started her career in downtown redevelopment when downtown redevelopment was decidedly not cool, you also found another pattern that fascinated me, and that was the relationship of a strong core city to housing prices remaining stable in the entire metropolitan area. What's going on there?
Well, our statistical analysis classifies metropolitan areas by how strong their close-in neighborhoods are. And we look basically at places that have lots of relatively well-educated people in their close-in neighborhoods. And we have good statistical evidence on that. And the thing that we found was that over the last year, housing prices have been stronger in those metropolitan areas that have strong urban cores, and actually that default and delinquency rates are lower in those metropolitan areas that have strong urban cores. And again, I think that comes back to, do you have a place that's got more choices for people and meets the needs of a variety of people in neighborhoods that don't require so much automobile travel?
I think that's a really interesting pattern that you found there. What happens if gas prices continue to rise as they promise to do? Do you expect the pattern that you've identified will only grow more severe?
Well, it's hard to say exactly. I think we have seen, you know, kind of a sea change in people's thinking about housing markets. And people are beginning to make some different changes, and it's showing up right away in these price patterns. And I would expect it to persist. Now, how much longer or how much greater it becomes is, I still think, an issue that we've got to follow closely and study more.
I was told recently by someone who knows that a grocery store chain had lost 3,000 employees in the past 5 months in a single major market because low-wage workers just could not afford to get to work. That's serious. And so what's going to happen here? I mean, that's another aspect of this gas price rise that I don't hear too much said about yet. I mean, is that going to also be part of the equation here?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways that'll affect the equation. I think part of it is people, you know, have driven relatively long distances for jobs that didn't pay all that well. And if you're earning minimum wage or even $10 or $12 an hour, that big increase in gas prices takes a very big bite out of your paycheck. And as we know, there are many suburban areas in the United States where the affordable housing is not found in all the suburbs. And for the people who work in grocery stores or in other retail and service activities, and even, you know, firefighters, police, and school teachers, working in some suburbs may mean long commutes from places where they can actually afford housing. And I think that means it'll be tougher and tougher to get workers, particularly for the lower paid jobs in a lot of these suburbs.
I'm just wondering, Joe, what will happen with retailers who have a business model. Many retailers have a business model built on low-wage workers.
And they are, of course, in far suburbs serving these far-flung residential markets. I mean, if they can't get people to work, what, they raise wages, they close suburban stores? What do you – play that out for me. What do you imagine happening?
Well, I think it changes the economics of it, and I think it makes them much more interested in what some folks call workforce housing. That is, can you have affordable housing near all the places where people work? Because there are a lot of places where there isn't affordable housing in metropolitan areas. I think there's another issue which has to do with not only getting your workers to your store, but your customers getting there as well. One of the assumptions behind a big box store, if you think about it, is the bigger the store, the further away customers will come to shop there. And really, the whole giant scale of a lot of retailing, big box retailing, is really predicated on getting people to drive long distances to shop, which is based on cheap gasoline. And I think that's one of the things that we may see change in the United States, is people may be more interested and retailers may find it more competitive to have more locations closer to where people live and probably smaller stores. In fact, there's a British grocery store chain that's just entered the United States in California called Tesco that is doing exactly that. They have these very small format stores that are about the tenth the size of a super center that aim to provide more convenient retailing closer to where people live.
How will politicians deal with this? Is this a problem that John McCain and Barack Obama need to be addressing?
Well, I think all politicians need to be thinking about this, because the way that we have grown is predicated on inexpensive gasoline in so many ways that we don't even really think about it. And I think there's a lot that government has to do to revisit some assumptions that we've made about very basic policies that we have and about how cities develop. Because I think the market is shifting in a different direction than we've experienced, or moving in a...
Earlier in the primary season, you remember that John McCain and Hillary Clinton were both proposing a gas tax holiday, which in the end, surprisingly, didn't go over that well with voters. And Barack Obama took a different position, saying, no, the gas tax holiday is just a temporary fix. It won't work. If you were advising one of these candidates and you said, look, here's an issue, and it's very real, and the federal government has spent a lot of money to enable this lifestyle that calls for us to spread out on the land, and it's built on cheap gas prices. The underlying factors have now changed, Mr. Candidate, and I think you need to get out there with something that will be good for the American people, will be a long-term strategy, and that people can understand, that's not going to drive votes away from you. What would you tell them?
Well, I think it's about a couple of things. I think it's, first of all, giving people more choices. What can we do so that people have alternatives that are practical alternatives that work well for them in their everyday lives, that let them travel by other modes of transportation, whether it's mass transit or walking or bicycle, and develop communities that have lots of convenient destinations close at hand, and that make it relatively easy to either not drive at all or drive shorter distances to those things that you want. And that's what people are already doing in their daily lives.
Okay, so how do you win Michigan with that strategy?
Well, I think Michigan, you know, faces a really big challenge, because the automobile industry is, you know, really dependent on cheap gasoline, and the sales of SUVs over the last decade or so have been the major source of profits for domestic manufacturers. So I think they've got to look for developing other products that people will want to buy. And I don't think, you know, I don't think the car is going to go away completely. But the market is clearly shifting towards much, much more fuel efficient vehicles. You know, if I were in Detroit, that's where I would definitely put my money. And I think from the standpoint of the federal government, we have an interest in making sure that U.S. companies and U.S. workers are the ones who are producing more fuel efficient vehicles.
You know, I've wondered, too, why, and maybe I'm just ill-informed, but I've wondered why automobile companies have not made more investment in transit. At one time, they disassembled transit in our cities, but you would think they would see some opportunities there, and it seems like most of the transit forward thinking is going on not in this country, but in others.
Yeah, I think, again, that's one of those things where we've, you know, viewed transit as second best or second class means of transportation. And it's for people who couldn't drive or couldn't afford cars. And, you know, that's one of those fundamental attitudinal changes that I think we have to make about how we build our cities and how they work so that we make it a really attractive alternative. And I think, if I were advising presidential candidates, maybe instead of a gas tax holiday, I'd have a transit fare holiday or a discount. Get people to try it more, because there would be huge benefits to the country to get more people using transit. That would cut the demand for gasoline and probably, help with the price of gasoline as well.
That sort of sounds like the way federal government works anyway. We'll give you a transit fare holiday and local government will pay for it.
Well, I'd want the federal government to chip in more to cover that, the cost of that.
But, I figured as much. Well, let's shift gears for a minute, and understanding that much of the action is at a local level. If you were advising a mayor in terms of this report you've done and how to respond to it, what would you advise him to do, or her?
As painful as it is in the short term to deal with the price of energy and the rising price of gasoline in particular, and there isn't a lot that mayors and local elected officials can do to address that, I think they have a lot that they can do to change the way their communities develop over time to give people more choices. And I think that comes in how you invest in your local transportation systems and your local mass transit systems in particular, and then how much density you allow to develop in communities, because I think density gives people more choices closer at hand. And I also think that things like redevelopment and infill and other public policies that will enable retrofitting neighborhoods that have developed in a lower density fashion in the past to develop with more mixed uses and more transit in the future.
Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about the Walk Score.
Walkscore.com, yes.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting if a mayor would take his or her community, shade it as to their Walk Score, basically develop a Walk Score matrix on top of the map, and have as a goal to increase the Walk Score every one of the communities by a certain percent within a certain time period. That might be an interesting goal for a mayor.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and it'd be a terrific antidote to the fixation that people have on things like the Texas Transportation's Congestion Index.
Which is what?
It's a measure of how much traffic there is on freeways, and basically you get better scores if cars can drive faster on your freeways, and which almost automatically leads you to saying, well, if we just built more freeways and people could drive faster, we'd be better off that way. But I think the Walk Score is a much, much better measure of how much choice people have in the neighborhoods that they live in, and how close schools and stores and retail outlets and coffee shops and libraries and schools and so on are to housing, which is really what people care about. It's not just traveling. It's you want to get somewhere.
Maybe we should suggest that to some mayor.
I think that's a great idea.
Well, we'll do it. Joe, it's always good to talk to you and have you on Smart City. I appreciate the good work you do. Thanks for being our guest.
Pleasure talking to you, Carol.
Joe Courtride is an economist for Impresa Consulting. His latest work, Driven to the Brink, explores the relationship between sky-high gas prices and the bottoming out of the housing market. If you're curious about WalkScore, that website Joe mentioned in the interview, it can be found at walkscore.com. Just type in your address and it displays amenities like restaurants, grocery stores, bars, and movie theaters in your neighborhood, and how you can reach them all by using your own 2 feet. I'm proud to say the WalkScore in my neighborhood is 98 out of 100. And we want to know what your Walk Score is. Send it to questions at smartcityradio.com, and we'll talk about them on a future show. For the latest news in the world of urban design and planning, we go to Planet as an assistant editor, Nate Berg.
The outlook from the suburbs continues to be bleak, with the 1-2 punch of the mortgage crisis and rising gas prices hitting hard across the nation. Suburban neighborhoods are emptying out, and blight is moving in the form of graffiti and unmowed lawns. Meanwhile, cities are growing in popularity and transit use is at an all-time high. Christopher Leinberger, an urban planning professor at the University of Michigan, sees the shift as a sign of things to come. Leinberger told CNN, quote, "The American dream is absolutely changing." This change is reflected in surveys that show that up to 40% of households in metropolitan areas want to live in a walkable urban area. With more and more people moving to the cities, abandonment is rampant. Residents of the suburbs are coping by mowing neighbors' lawns and drafting up new anti-blight regulations. But with gas prices continuing to rise and housing prices continuing to drop in many areas, it may be a long time before relief is found. Another unexpected effect of rising gas prices is the growing popularity of an unlikely form of alternative transportation. All across the country, golf carts are venturing outside the country club and into everyday use. Faced with gas prices reaching almost $5 a gallon in some places, many Americans are using the typically recreational vehicles for local everyday trips. More and more retirement communities are encouraging this mode of transport because of its low emissions and relatively quiet engine. Unfortunately, this eco-conscious choice can also be dangerous. The Journal of Trauma, Injury, Infection, and Critical Care found that there were over 40,000 golf cart-related injuries between 2000 and 2005. Though this number is nowhere near the amount of regular car-related injuries, many are cautioning communities against rushing to integrate the modest golf carts into everyday traffic, dominated by much bigger and much stronger automobiles. Meanwhile, on the Mediterranean coast, one of the famed playgrounds of the rich and famous is facing some tough times. The Principality of Monaco is known widely as the home of the Monte Carlo Casino, but it is also one of the densest countries in the world. Measuring less than 1 square mile, the country has officially run out of space. But Monaco's Prince Albert has plans to expand. The prince is said to be reviewing architectural plans for an extension that would jut out from the coast, supported by stilts. Environmentalists have worries that the project will endanger the nearby coastal marine ecology. Albert, who has long championed environment-friendly projects like car sharing and electric cars, is said to be looking carefully at the environmental impact of his project. He is hoping to make the Monaco project a model of sustainable development and eco-technology. And with plenty of resources on hand, his country, a notorious tax haven, may just be able to pull it off. And finally, in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, a long-lost lighthouse has been found. Wellfleet is located between the tip and the elbow of Cape Cod, and Wellfleet Harbor was once home to a 30-foot-tall cast-iron lighthouse. But sometime in the 1930s, it disappeared. In the 70-plus years that followed, historians assumed that it had just been destroyed. But last week, researcher Colleen McNaney rediscovered the missing tower in, of all places, California. There is no record of the lighthouse's cross-country journey, but a plaque mounted on the base confirms its origin. The former Massachusetts lighthouse now stands in Point Montara, California, where it serves as a hostel for students, and appropriately, travelers. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a break, Smart City producer Scotty Iseri will show you some interesting and intelligent ways of getting around that will get you out of your car and into the city. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. One of the things urban density can offer is a wide variety of ways to get around. After reading Joe Courtwright's report, Driven to the Brink, Smart City radio producer Scotty Iseri has been inspired to seek out other new forms of transit in a city. Scotty, what have you got for us?
Hi, Carol. So listen to this sound real quick. I'm going to play a sound for you. So what do you think that is?
Sounds like a motorcycle, maybe? Maybe an underpowered motorcycle?
Underpowered. That is the sound. I will have you know, that is the sound of my scooter. It's 150 cc's of pure two-wheeled transportation. So I've been driving scooters for a few years now, and it seems like other people are joining me. So I went out and talked to some people about scooters and why so many people are hopping on this two-wheeled transport.
In the movie Roman Holiday, Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck tour the streets of Rome on a Vespa scooter. With some bumpy results. Scooters have long had the image as a leisure vehicle, but these days, more and more people are considering two-wheeled transport as a good choice for everyday driving. This is the showroom floor at Scooter Works, a scooter dealership on the north side of Chicago.
We're very, very busy, and we have a bigger demand than we have a supply.
That's Ken Rudoy. He's the sales manager at Scooter Works, and he's been pretty busy lately. But he's glad to be working so hard.
12 hours a day, every day, selling scooters. Every scooter we get our hands on, we can sell. People are waking up and realizing that this is an alternate way of transportation throughout the city for a very low cost to keep their costs down. I'm almost at the point that I could almost give up my car.
But it's not just this one shop in Chicago. Nationwide, scooter sales are up. So says Mike Mount of the Motorcycle Industry Council.
They have. Looking back over the past decade or so, they've been the fastest growing segment in the motorcycle market percentage-wise. For one, they're just a lot of fun to ride, and I think they're an easy entree for some people into the world of two-wheeling, which for some people is something that they've wanted to get into a long time and are now checking that off the list. And then if you look pretty much anywhere in the media, in magazines, on the big screen, on the small screen, in advertising, scooters are popping up everywhere. So I think you're seeing more of them out there, and they're generating more interest. I think scooters are definitely cool now.
It's more than just the perception of scooters that's changed. Many buyers are saying that the scooter's biggest selling point is the gas mileage. Ralph Hesta is a photographer. He's looking at a large black scooter in the Scooter Works parking lot, and he's thinking about his commute.
It's going to be about 12, 13 miles, I think, Rogers Park to the west side. I think I drive a Honda Pilot now, and thinking about an alternative to, you know, go to work and back. Honda Pilot gets about 18 miles a gallon, and, you know, at $4 or $5 or $6 a gallon, you know, it's getting a little much just to pop down to the studio and, you know, work on the computer for a few hours. It doesn't pay. You know, I'm not a motorcycle kind of guy. I'm not looking to do 90 miles an hour, you know, and do wheelies on Lakeshore Drive or anything, but just simple, you know, inexpensive transportation.
When you go to the gas station and spend $5 and you look at the SUV next to you that just spent $75, you really smile a lot.
Again, Ken Rudoy.
I have customers that have, I had one guy that does a specialty wine delivery. He has switched from his car to his scooter. Last summer alone, he paid for the scooter and the savings from gasoline, parking, car insurance, and everything. I have another customer who has a dog walking business. She paid her scooter off last summer by just using the scooter to and from her jobs. This is perfect because they can get anywhere in town rather quickly and a very reasonably priced, and you can sneak it in a tiny little parking spot. There are people using this for their to and from transportation for work, for delivery, for whatever. So the return on your investment is pretty quick.
Scooters have become so popular that many dealerships are running low on stock. Sean Cummings is the director of sales for Scooter Works USA.
Normally, every company, like our sister company, Genuine, or Kymco, Sim, all the big manufacturers of scooters, they're upping their percentage over last year by about 30%, saying, okay, we think we can grow this much. That's what we're going to produce.
They're making 30%.
30% more every year. So this year, they also said, okay, we plan on making about 30% more because traditionally that's what we sell out of. This year, everybody has been out of scooters left and right. Every manufacturer, every scooter shop in the country calls us, and I'm not kidding, every day begging for more scooters. We can't produce them fast enough right now for sales, to keep up with sales. It's a problem we have, but it's a great problem to have.
Scooters can be a great choice for city driving, but you need to be a little cautious. Mike Mount of the Motorcycle Industry Council offers advice not only for scooter drivers, but also for people sharing the road in their cars.
It's important to get trained and licensed, to wear protective gear at all times. Don't drink and ride. Ride within your limits and be a lifelong learner, meaning come back for refresher riding courses. For car drivers, please look out for motorcyclists. Focus on driving. That means hang up the phone, put down the food. Use your turn signals. Give two-wheelers some room. And keep it in the car, meaning don't throw trash and cigarettes out the window.
So, Carol, is that enough to make you want to get a scooter?
Well, I have two questions.
Okay.
One, I'm not sure where I would park it. And for me, that's a big issue. I live in downtown, and I do not want – I'm morally against buying a parking place. There's just something wrong with that. So that would be my first question. But the second question, and this will make me sound hopelessly naive. I don't know how to drive one. I'm a little bit, I've always loved the Vespas. They're so gorgeous. But I've wondered, what does it take to drive one?
Well, for me, it's easy as riding a bike. If you can ride
Is it
a bike,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. It's just a little bit of balance and you're fine. Off you go, zipping through traffic. As far as parking goes, it varies state by state. I know in Chicago, some people park them on the sidewalks, although you're technically not supposed to. That's legal in some cities. But the greatest thing about parking is that you can slide it right between two cars. Have you ever driven past a spot that there's a car on either side and it's just too small to get a full-size car in there? Scooter just slides right in there. So you can park. Parking is very, very easy in this, at least in Chicago.
In that case, it's pretty appealing, although I have to say right now I'm making do without a car, and that's the best world of all.
Sure, and you're not alone in saying that. As popular as scooters are, and despite the great gas mileage, some people are very earth conscious, like yourself. They want something with no carbon footprint and that puts no carbon in the atmosphere, and they're willing to go all out for it. Andrew Bedno, thank you for being on Smart City Radio. So tell me about World Naked Bike Ride.
This is the fifth annual event in Chicago. It's international in scope. If you hit the site worldnakedbikeride.org, you'll see dozens of cities nationwide participating. Chicago, simply by nature of its size, ended up being among the top turnouts, up with London, Vancouver. It's the tagline is promoting freedom from oil addiction and positive body image. A lot of people treat it just as we're using nudity to bring attention to the need more respect for bicyclists angle. You know, it's a natural outgrowth. It's a symptom of the times that some significant protest of oil addiction had to happen. And we're simply using the Lady Godiva principle on that.
Now, what is the Lady Godiva principle?
I got a doctoral degree and nobody cared, but I take off my clothes and I got everyone's attention. The meaning of this ride has changed over the years. Now in its fifth year, you know, in the first couple of years, we were, look at those crazy hippies, oh, get lost, I'm buying my SUV, to now we're truisms. It's not a protest. It's not about, like, we need to bring your attention to this problem. Now we're celebrating the end of the oil era. We already passed the peak oil production point. You know, we're on the downturn. The end of the great oil era has come.
So what are riders going to be doing today? They're going to be starting in a park, and then what?
Covering a leisurely 10 miles of a lot of joyful noise and waving to people on the streets and passing out thousands of little flyers about, like, what you can do to reduce your oil consumption and why are we here and why are we naked. And, you know, if we change one person, it was worth it.
So what makes bicycles uniquely suited towards commuting or towards getting around a city?
Bikes are a great solution because the gear ratios allow it to be fantastically efficient. That is your best miles per calorie solution. So that's why bikes. Bikes are already well supported by the infrastructure. You know, bikes are a part of the human experience at this point, hundreds of years old. In Chicago in particular, there's very few cities like this. I mean, Chicago, Paris, and Belgium, let's say. We get more bike lanes or wider bike lanes, or eventually, the thing I said last year everybody seemed to love was, let's dedicate some streets. You know, like State Street was once a pedestrian mall. At some point, to make it more bike-friendly, there are radical plans. Then, like, you look to Europe, the whole thing about rental bikes, which negates the whole question of things like theft.
Can you define that concept for me? What is a rental bike?
Well, it's my understanding that some European cities have put in completely automated systems that involve bike racks that automatically lock your bike and take note that you have returned that bike or when you take out a bike. So it becomes really just a pool of bikes to draw from. At some point, there's a sign-up process, you know, a credit card securing that you're not going to steal the bike. But after that, it becomes just like a CTA system. You flash your card at the machine, and it unlocks the bike, and you can use it for a couple of hours.
Excellent. So will you be getting naked today on the naked bike ride?
I think other admin personnel tend not to. I always dress in it. I always wear a safety vest because I care about being spotted, about people knowing that I'm watching their backs and their sides and such, so I don't get to yet. There's actually a lot of things that the people, the volunteers who help make this a better ride, would love to do that we don't get to do, and we just chalk it off to duty. I was talking to the route leader the past 2 years, and he doesn't really get to experience the ride at all because he's in front the whole time. And I'm like, so, well, that's the price we pay. But I won't be, but something really significant, if you look at the past photos, I have endless appreciation and respect and I'm just flabbergasted by the number of people who were completely nude. So the people really do jump right in, and I'm very proud of them all.
The nude riders today, what are they going to have to be looking out for? Is this legal?
Well, we do keep it absolutely within the realm of legal through, there's a ride guideline statement you should see, and that's part of, I think, why we're getting along with police well in the past few years, is we do say full frontal goodies, I put in the last note actually, may make you a target, even naked butts are risky, and that comes from a thorough review by our legal people too, of the exact terms of the city statutes in question. Bottom line, if you are naked and a cop stops you and says, put something on, just do it. And then you're pretty much set. Okay, San Francisco calls it a critical mass with a really lenient dress code, which is a good way of looking at it.
How will you define a successful naked bike ride today? What's it going to look like if this is a success today?
Oh, well, a success, I'll tell you, we redefined this year success as from how many people came out, because we're satisfied with the number of people. At this point, we're perfectly huge. We don't want to, any bigger, it really gets to be a struggle in the streets and stuff. So I think we're defining, I hate to sound hokey or Boy Scout, but I think we're defining a success this time as everybody's safe.
Excellent. Andrew Bednow, thanks for being on Smart City Radio.
My pleasure.
Scotty, I have to ask, did you go to the naked bike ride?
Shy, demure me, did I go to the naked bike ride? I saw part of it. And I saw some naked butts, but it was a lot of fun. They had a really good turnout, and the weather was perfect for it. It was nice and warm.
I have to tell you, 2 years ago, we were on Randolph with my 80-year-old mother, my sister from Memphis, my nephew, 18 years old, and our stepchildren. And we happened upon the naked bike ride, and that turned out to be the highlight of my mother's trip. She she was so astounded at what happens in the big city of Chicago. We were all pretty astounded. Hard to explain that's what goes on in your city.
Sure. But sometimes a bike is not the greatest way to get around. It's not everyone wants to bike in the cold, not everyone wants to bike in the rain. And if that's the case, you want to turn to public transportation. Carol, you said you're doing without a car.
We don't depend on a car.
So I take it you ride some public transportation every now and then.
You know what? I love the freedom of knowing I can walk out my door and pretty much catch the first bus that comes along and figure out a way to get where I'm going. It's great. Even though we complain about the Chicago Transit Authority and the slow zones on the L and sometimes the buses are too crowded, but for the most part, really, this system works unbelievably well.
Well, you're not alone in that. There's a lot of people out there that are using the internet to express these same kind of complaints, as well as some praises of public transit. There's the overheadwire.com, which is a blog that discusses nationwide transit issues, so cities that are trying to create transit systems. And there's TriMedicate, which is Portland, Oregon's TriMet system, and it talks about funny happenings and personal stories that happen on their public transportation.
TriMet is a fabulous system.
I agree. Here in Chicago, we have something called the CTA Tattler. CTA, the Chicago Transit Authority, as you said, they operate the subway and the buses and the commuter trains. I got a chance to speak with the editor of the CTA Tattler, Kevin O'Neill.
Yeah, I'm Kevin O'Neill. I'm sole proprietor and writer of CTATattler.com. Well, CTA Tattler is a blog, but it's more than a blog. It's a community of writers of the CTA where they come together and find news, notes, and crazy stuff that I write about that I see and hear on the CTA. And I think it's also been like a forum of late for people to kind of weigh in on some of the nutty things happening, primarily on the political front at the CTA. I'll write about what others are writing about. You know, I'll link to stories in the Tribune and Sun-Times or wherever. But I also have sources inside the CTA. I talk to state legislators. I like to think that I go a little extra step in trying to do some reporting. I like to think that CTA Tattler is going to first raise issues that are important to everyday riders like me. I'm an everyday rider. I'm going to be an outlet forum for discussion. The community that we've developed at ctatadler.com is informed on the issues and passionate about the CTA, because everybody has a crazy CTA experience. I mean, the Chicago Transit Authority, you know, it's 1.5 million rides a day, so you're going to see lots of crazy things happening. So I try to chronicle that. People get on a train and it's you're in your own world. You have your iPod, you're reading your newspaper, you're reading a book, you're sleeping. You try not to be aware of other people, and you hope that they're not aware of you. And because of that dynamic, it makes people think that, well, I'm not aware of them, so they're not aware of me. And that spawns some goofy behavior. You know, I've seen people clipping their fingernails and toenails.
Toenails,
yeah. You don't really want to do that. I've seen them trimming their mustache and nose hairs. The stuff that I write about, you're not usually going to see in your day-to-day commute, but for the most part, it is being done by usual or by ordinary folks, for the most part. That's what makes it so interesting and also leads to some of the nutty cell phone conversations, which I like to chronicle as the best sellers, CELLERS, of course. I also like it when people lie. I've heard people, you know, just outright lying on the cell phones. Yeah, hey, this is Bill. You know, we've been delayed 15 minutes on this train, so I'm going to be late to work. Just wanted you to know. You know, for the most part, my ride on the CTA is pretty, you know, uneventful for the most part. It's gotten longer, primarily because CTA is finally putting some money into fixing slow zones and fixing track. And so as a result of that, trains are delayed. But you know what they say, temporary inconvenience or permanent improvement. So, and it's good to see the investment going into public transportation. You know, we need to, you know, invest our capital funds in public transportation. As just as we build roads, I think we need, you know, we've seen too many roads built. We need to be continuing to fund routes, new buses, new trains, capital improvements to the infrastructure. It's just a whole different universe out there. So, plus, I don't have to drive. God knows it's very expensive, number one, to park downtown where I work, and now it's very expensive to buy gas. When you're in your car, you do have to focus. You obviously can't read or sleep. You can still pick your nose, and I've seen plenty of drivers and CTA riders picking your nose, and that's fine. I think we've all been guilty of that, but it's funny to see it. But it is different, certainly. Because you're not sharing that. You're sharing a road with other people, but you're not sharing that confined space with other people. That's what I was talking about earlier, where you're in a confined space, and you're all sharing that confined space, but you think you have your own little pocket, your own environment. I've used public transportation pretty much all my life. Public transportation in a city, I mean, it connects people is what it does, and it gives you alternatives to driving. It's such an experience when people from, you know, I see people from small towns, you know, particularly it seems like, you know, going to the Cubs games and they're just all so very excited and it's so fun and oh my gosh, there's Wrigley Field, and it is exciting. And I'm, you know, it might seem like I'm making fun of it, but I'm really not, because it truly is an exhilarating experience. You know, we all take it for granted, those of us who you know, come out of a tunnel and up to the elevated tracks and see the, you know, the cemetery lying, you know, above us, or right below us, and going across the river and seeing the river below us. I mean, these are all experiences that we've all seen every day in, day out, but it's kind of cool, you know? And if you grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin, I don't know, if you haven't experienced it, it is truly a good, fun, exhilarating experience. So that's what this city is about. Yes, I love riding public transportation.
So that's Kevin O'Neill of the CTA Tattler. And that's a report on three different ways of getting around the city. There's one problem with these three reports, Carol. They're all very Chicago-centric. We're, of course, produced based out of Chicago, and I'd like to put it out to the listeners. I'd like to hear I'd like to hear how they get around their cities. If they want to shoot us an email, questions@smartcityradio.com, tell us how you get around your city.
Scotty, thanks for bringing those in.
My pleasure. And for the record, Carol, the walk score in my neighborhood is a not-too-shabby 88 out of 100.
Scotty Iseri produces Smart City, and he gets around town any way he can. This week, like every week, we give the last word over to Walker Smith. We find a lot of our stories about transit through the internet, and our City Views commentator Walker Smith is thinking about the virtual world and the way the virtual world of the internet can enhance our lives offline.
For all the attention being given to virtual communities, it seems that the real impact of the internet is to connect us more closely than ever to our traditional geographic communities. For example, consider storytelling narrated by Google Mashups. Penguin Books recently sponsored a digital initiative in which it worked with six authors to tell six stories within 6 weeks. One of these stories, called 21 Steps, was inspired by the thriller 39 Steps. It leads the viewer through the plot by linking each paragraph to a corresponding geographic location on a London map. The story is literally embedded in the map. You read the story by moving from flag to flag and clicking for the text. It is a virtual experience, of course, but it also facilitates the direct connection of the story to an actual physical location. The physical geography makes the virtual storytelling possible, which in turn enhances the meanings and connotations that the reader can carry with him or her to that physical location in the future. In short, our connection with place is enhanced, not severed, by this virtual tool. Something similar is emerging in news reporting. Editors and reporters have known for decades that one of the biggest complaints people have about reporting is the dearth of coverage for particular communities or neighborhoods. People want news about the specific places in which they live. But unfortunately, limits on resources, news hole, and broader public interest have kept local newspapers from regularly covering all the goings-on in every neighborhood. The internet is changing that. Every block is a news website that aggregates, filters, and provides access for all of the news relevant to very small, specific geographic areas in San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. The software scours the web for the information and then organizes it into neighborhood reports or local user access. Every block covers government databases like restaurant inspections, building permits, and crime reports, as well as local photos from Flickr, user reviews of local businesses from Yelp, local listings on Craigslist, and any pertinent news stories. NewsGarden is an interactive news site launched by Sara Media that provides hyper-local news coverage through a combination of user-generated stories and photos, social networking, neighborhood news filtering, comments and reviews, geo-targeted advertising, and Google mashups to match stories with map locations. Both NewsGarden and EveryBlock are virtual tools that enmesh people even more deeply into their real-world physical geographies. There is lots of hand-wringing that the internet is breaking down our traditional communities by disconnecting us from our neighbors and isolating us in virtual worlds. No doubt, some of that is going on. But the bigger, more fundamental impact of the Internet is much more palpable. For in its virtual way, the Internet is enhancing and enriching our appreciation of and connection with our actual and real worlds. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, register for our weekly newsletter, and to read the full report of Driven to the Brink. Got a question or a comment about anything you heard on this week's show? Send it in to questions@smartcityradio.com. We want to hear your feedback about the show and about your favorite ways of getting around your city. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Additional music this week was provided by Anthony Barilla. Scotty Iseri is our producer, engineer, and resident scooter enthusiast. Thanks for listening. I'm Carol Coletta.